What if I told you Microsoft actually scrambled to patch over 600 critical security holes this morning? Like, all while they're simultaneously preparing to effectively kill off the physical Xbox.
I mean, it is a profound structural earthquake for the industry, honestly.
It really is.
The industry is basically trying to bury its legacy hardware at the exact same moment that purely digital companies are realizing, well, they need to invent physical moving hardware just to get closer to you, the user.
Yeah.
So the physical and the digital are essentially trading places right now.
Which is, that is the perfect framing for our mission today. Because you're here listening because you want a quick, thorough understanding of this wildly shifting landscape, but, you know, without getting buried in the information overload.
Right, exactly.
So we are diving into the July 15th, 2026 edition of the Tekken Morning Newsletter. We're going to be tracking everything from the death of the gaming console to the birth of screenless AI companions, plus the physics of new microchips and the strange new rules of Wall Street crypto.
It's a packed newsletter today.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. And let's start with just the sheer scale of the panic at Microsoft right now. Because their historic Patch Tuesday just shattered records.
Yeah, and not in a good way.
Definitely not. They patched 622 vulnerabilities in a single day.
Which is a number that represents three times their previous record from just last month.
Three times. That's wild.
Right. And out of those, 143 were classified as critical.
And critical doesn't just mean, like, slightly buggy, right?
No, in the cybersecurity realm, critical is absolutely not a suggestion. It means the bug could lead to immediate data theft, stealth malware installation, or, you know, a complete system hijacking.
Oh, wow.
And these vulnerabilities are embedded deep within Windows 11, Windows Server, Office 365, and Exchange Server.
Yeah, the newsletter actually highlighted that two of these are active zero days, which means hackers are already exploiting them right now.
Yes.
One is in Active Directory and the other in SharePoint. The specific codes were CVE-2026-56155 and 56164.
Correct.
And the key term the newsletter used for both is privilege escalation. So in plain English, for all of us, how does that actually work mechanically?
So think of a corporate computer network like a massive secure hotel.
Oh, yeah, hotel.
Privilege escalation means an attacker manages to sneak in the back door as just a regular guest.
Right.
So they only have the key to a single standard room. But because of a flaw in the hotel software, they're able to trick the system into swapping their standard room key for the master key card.
Oh, the one that opens the penthouse and the vault.
Exactly. The penthouse, the security room, everything. They escalate their basic access into full administrative control. And, you know, once they hold that master key, the entire sister is essentially theirs.
Man. Which explains why cybersecurity researcher Kevin Beaumont was so incredibly blunt in his assessment today.
Yeah.
Because he basically argued that massive tech companies need to stop churning out new features and start actually securing their old code.
Yeah, he is pointing directly at this concept of technical debt. Microsoft has spent the last decade aggressively piling modern cloud services and, you know, AI integrations on top of software architecture that is, honestly, in some cases, 20 years old.
20 years old. Yeah, that's practically ancient in tech years.
It really is. And when you stretch old code to do things it was never designed to do, it fractures.
Yeah.
Releasing 622 patches in one day, it forces IT administrators into this nightmare scenario.
Because they have to drop everything and patch it?
Exactly. They patch immediately, or they leave their systems exposed to attackers who now have a highly detailed public map of every single vulnerability Microsoft just admitted to having.
It's like Microsoft did a massive spring cleaning of their digital mansion, but then realized the front door was left wide open for burglars.
That's a great way to put it.
It just feels like the company's collapsing a bit under the weight of its own legacy footprint. And it's not just their software legacy that's struggling right now. The physical hardware they've relied on for decades is taking a massive hit, too.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, both of these things show a company pivoting aggressively toward cloud services.
Right.
Because the S&P Global Market Intelligence forecast released today paints an incredibly stark picture for the Xbox.
It's pretty grim. They're projecting Xbox console sales to plummet to just 2.5 million units for all of 2026.
And for context, that is the lowest point yet for this entire generation of consoles.
Mm-hmm.
The forecast goes even further, actually projecting sales to essentially flatline towards zero by 2032.
Wait, really? Towards zero?
Yes. even their highly anticipated next-generation console, which is known as Project Helix.
Right, the new one.
It's only projected to move about 2 million units in its first year. Meanwhile, Sony's PlayStation 6 is expected to outsell it by a margin of 10 million units in that same window.
Wow. I mean, a 10 million unit gap isn't just a lost battle. That's a lost war.
Bro, absolutely.
And Xbox chief Phil Spencer has been hinting at a shift away from consoles toward this sort of Netflix of gaming model for a while now. But seeing the actual hardware numbers evaporate like that is jarring.
It is.
So why would Microsoft just let the bottom fall out of a brand as iconic as Xbox?
Well, because they made a very calculated decision to devalue the physical box in favor of the cloud.
Right.
Over the last few years, Microsoft took its biggest exclusive franchises like Halo, Gears of War, Forza.
They're heavy hitters.
Exactly. And they started publishing them on rival platforms like PlayStation and the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, which is kind of crazy if you think about it.
It changes everything. If a consumer can play Microsoft's best games on a Sony console, the incentive to buy the physical Xbox just vanishes.
Right. Why buy both?
Exactly. And they also aggressively pushed Game Pass, which is their incredibly lucrative subscription service. It lets you stream games directly to your PC or your smart TV without needing the console at all.
So they're basically abandoning the living room hardware so they can own the invisible infrastructure.
That's exactly what they're doing.
I mean, it's a brilliant pivot for their bottom line, but it leaves the consumer in a very strange place. Because if Xbox just exits the physical hardware market entirely, gamers are left with this duopoly of Sony and Nintendo.
Right.
And history tells us that when hardware competition dies, innovation stalls out and prices skyrocket.
It's a huge monopolistic risk for gamers. The golden era of the console war is effectively over. Microsoft is leaving the physical living room behind to live in the data center.
But nature abhors a vacuum. As Microsoft pulls its hardware out of our homes, a company that has famously only existed in the digital realm is suddenly trying to build new physical hardware.
Yes, OpenAI.
Yeah. The newsletter says OpenAI is reportedly launching its first consumer device in late 2026.
It's a really fascinating pivot.
It's a smart speaker powered by a GPT-4 plus level AI, and they're pricing it pretty aggressively between $200 and $300.
Mm.
But here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
The detail that just stops me in my tracks is that this device is entirely screenless.
Yeah, no screen at all.
Which is wild because we have spent the last 15 years putting high-definition touchscreens on literally everything. Refrigerators, thermostats, cars. So taking the screen away, it kind of feels like going backward to go forward. Are we moving from treating our tech like tools to treating them like pets?
That is a great question. It is a severe departure from the current design consensus, for sure.
Definitely.
But OpenAI is essentially forcing a pivot from visual computing to physical ambient computing.
Ambient computing.
Right. The CEO, Sam Altman, he noted in his announcement that they want to build a device that talks to you like a real friend, not just a robot waiting for a command prompt.
Interesting.
See, a screen actually acts as a barrier. It demands your visual focus and forces you to interact on the machine's terms through a user interface.
Like pushing buttons on an app.
Exactly. So removing the screen strips away the barrier. It makes the interaction purely conversational, which mimics how humans naturally interact with each other.
And they're apparently doubling down on that human mimicry. Because the leaks suggest the device incorporates these subtle mechanical moving elements.
Yes.
So it won't just sit there statically like a glowing hockey puck on your counter.
No, not at all.
It actually uses physical head tracking to turn toward you when you speak. And it performs these subtle nodding motions to signal that it's listening and processing.
Which is a complete masterstroke in psychological design.
Right.
I mean, Amazon's Alexa and Google's Nest have controlled the hardware ecosystem in the smart home for a decade now.
Yeah, everyone has one.
Right. But their underlying artificial intelligence is incredibly brittle when it comes to natural language.
True. They're mostly just glorified voice-activated egg timers.
Exactly. Egg timers and light switches.
Yeah.
But OpenAI possesses an overwhelming advantage in natural language understanding. Their AI remembers what you were anxious about yesterday. It understands your tone of voice, and it can synthesize proactive suggestions. So by taking that immense cognitive power and pairing it with physical nonverbal cues, like turning to actually look at you, they are completely crossing the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
They aren't just selling a smart hub. They are selling emotional companionship.
See, that immediately triggers alarm bells for me regarding privacy.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if I have a mechanical device tracking my physical location in the room, analyzing the emotional cadence of my voice, mm-hmm. and building a deep contextual profile of my habits, I mean, I need to know exactly where that data is going.
And that is the defining hurdle for ambient computing right there.
Yeah.
But OpenAI's solution is to process the vast majority of routine tasks locally, right on the physical device itself.
Oh, okay.
This is known as edge computing. So the audio of your daily conversations doesn't get streamed back to a centralized cloud server. Not unless you ask a highly complex query that requires massive external computing power.
So the data stays local.
Everything else stays in the room with you.
But, I mean, to process complex natural language and emotional tone in real time, locally, without massive lag, that requires an unbelievable amount of computing power squeezed into a tiny $300 cylinder.
It really does.
And you can't build that without fundamentally changing the silicon that powers it, which leads us directly to the massive hardware breakthroughs happening behind the scenes, specifically with AMD.
Right, because the intelligence of that screenless companion is entirely dependent on the physical architecture of the chips powering it and the servers supporting it.
Exactly.
AMD just showcased their Zen 6 Venice processor at the Advancing AI 2026 event.
And the specs they announced are staggering. They are utilizing TSMC's 2-nanometer process to pack 256 cores into a single processor.
Yep.
Just for perspective, their previous generation, the Genoa, had 96 cores.
Right. So in a single generational leap, they have increased parallel processing capacity by 2.6 times.
Which is huge.
In the realm of AI and big data, parallel processing is basically everything.
Why is that?
Because when you are training a large language model or querying billions of data points, the computer isn't solving one really hard math problem. It's solving millions of smaller math problems simultaneously.
Ah, okay.
So moving from 96 cores to 256 cores means a single server rack can now do the work of three older racks. AMD claims this will yield up to 1.7 times faster AI performance.
Okay, so it's like instead of just building a faster car, AMD just built a highway with 256 lanes.
Exactly.
But AMD CEO Lisa Su didn't just focus on the raw speed during the announcement. She heavily emphasized that the Zen 6 delivers 30% better performance per watt.
Yes, she did.
I want to dig into the physics of this for a moment. Because why is the tech industry so obsessed with power efficiency? If I'm a massive AI data center operator, shouldn't my only metric be how fast the chips can think?
Well, the thing is, speed is completely irrelevant if you can't afford to plug it in.
Okay, fair point.
The commercial reality of artificial intelligence right now is that electricity is a massive operational expense. It's the ultimate bottleneck.
Because they draw so much power.
Right. Data centers are drawing gigawatts of power from the grid. And it's not just the electricity required to make the chips run. It's the electricity required to stop them from melting.
Wow, melting?
Yeah, when a processor calculates, it generates immense heat. If it gets too hot, it automatically throttles its own speed down to prevent physical damage. So data centers spend millions on industrial liquid cooling and huge air conditioning systems.
Man. So how does shrinking the manufacturing process down to 2 nanometers actually solve that heat problem?
It all comes down to the literal distance an electron has to travel.
Okay.
A nanometer is unimaginably small, right? Like, a single sheet of paper is about 100,000 nanometers thick.
That puts it in perspective.
So when TSMC builds a 2-nanometer chip, they're packing the microscopic transistors so tightly together that the electrical signals have a shorter distance to travel.
Oh, I see.
And less distance means less electrical resistance. Less resistance means less power is lost as waste heat.
So it runs cooler.
Exactly. The chip runs cooler, requires less voltage to operate, and saves the data center an absolute fortune in cooling costs.
That's wild.
That 30% improvement in performance per watt is quite literally the difference between an AI company turning a profit or going bankrupt. So getting more transistors into that 2-nanometer space isn't just about speed. It's about making the entire AI revolution economically sustainable.
And this places AMD in a very aggressive posture against the rest of the industry, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Because NVIDIA has completely dominated the AI GPU market.
Right.
And Intel is desperately trying to perfect their own 18A manufacturing process, which is their equivalent to this 2-nanometer technology.
They are. And AMD is aiming for a commercial release by late 2026.
Which could allow them to capture a massive share of the server infrastructure before the competitors even catch up.
Definitely. They are positioning themselves as the comprehensive provider because an AI data center needs dense CPUs for analytics and database management, working in tandem with GPUs for the actual machine learning part.
Right.
So AMD is proving they can supply the foundational muscle for the entire ecosystem.
But I know there has to be a ceiling to this progress.
Yes.
Because we are talking about 2 nanometer transistors. A single silicon atom is about 0.2 nanometers wide.
Right.
So you can only shrink these gates so much before you hit the literal physical limits of the universe.
Which is where electrons start randomly jumping across the microscopic barriers.
Right, that phenomenon called quantum tunneling.
Exactly.
So classical computing, which is based on ones and zeros, is running out of road. And that reality explains IBM's massive announcement today in the newsletter.
Yes, the transition from classical physics to quantum mechanics. IBM has committed $10 billion over the next 5 years entirely to quantum computing research, development, and scaling.
$10 billion is a massive bet. And we have to move past the traditional analogies here.
I agree.
Usually people explain quantum computing by saying, like, a classical computer is a person trying to find the center of a maze by walking down every dead end one by one, while a quantum computer tries every path at the same time.
Right, the maze analogy.
Yeah, but that doesn't actually explain the mechanics of how a qubit replaces a traditional bit.
So let's use a different framework.
Okay.
A classical bit is a light switch. It is definitively on or definitively off, a one or a zero.
Right.
A qubit, utilizing the quantum principle of superposition, is more like a coin spinning in the air.
Okay.
While it's spinning, it isn't heads or tails. It's a dynamic probability of both at the same time.
Got it.
But the real power comes from entanglement. So imagine dropping a dozen stones into a calm pond.
The ripples spread out.
Exactly. The ripples spread out. And where they crash into each other, they either cancel each other out or they combine to make a much larger wave.
Right. Interference.
Yes. A quantum computer links hundreds of qubits together, setting up this highly complex wave of probabilities. It engineers the ripples so that all the incorrect answers to a problem cancel each other out, and the correct answer amplifies into a massive wave that the scientists can read.
So it calculates through probability rather than basic binary logic.
Exactly.
That's incredible. And IBM's stated goal is to reach quantum utility by 2027.
Right.
They define this as the moment a quantum computer stops being a fascinating laboratory experiment and starts actually solving real-world problems that classical computers simply cannot handle.
And they're already doing applications. They're collaborating with the Cleveland Clinic and Oak Ridge National Lab right now to simulate the behavior of complex materials for fusion energy calculations.
Well, let me press on this $10 billion figure for a second.
Sure.
Because what does this all actually mean for us today? Qubits are incredibly fragile.
Very fragile.
A slight change in temperature or like a stray magnetic field causes them to lose their quantum state, which leads to massive error rates.
Yeah, it's called quantum noise.
Right. So Is throwing $10 billion at a machine that still struggles with fundamental noise a brilliant long-term play? Or is it just an expensive PR stunt while other tech companies are busy cutting R&D?
What's fascinating here is that it is the ultimate existential bet.
How so?
Because a significant portion of that $10 billion isn't just going toward building bigger machines. It's going specifically toward quantum error correction.
We're trying to fix the noise?
Exactly. They are trying to build software and hardware fail-safes that catch and fix those fragile errors in real time. And the company that solves error correction secures a monopoly on a trillion-dollar frontier.
Right, because a fully functional, error-corrected quantum computer changes human capabilities overnight.
Entirely. It allows for perfect molecular simulation, meaning you could discover new life-saving pharmaceuticals in days rather than decades.
Wow.
It allows for the instantaneous optimization of global supply chains and power grids. But most urgently, it breaks cryptography.
Which brings in the whole geopolitical race angle.
Oh, completely.
Because the newsletter highlights that China is pouring immense state resources into their own quantum programs, too.
And this is why it's a race. Currently, all global banking, military communications, and internet traffic are secured by RSA encryption.
Which relies on really complex math.
Right, factoring unimaginably large prime numbers. A math problem that would take a classical supercomputer literally millions of years to solve.
But a quantum computer.
An error-corrected quantum computer could run an algorithm to solve it in seconds.
In seconds. Man.
The first nation or corporation to achieve a stable quantum advantage essentially holds the skeleton key to the world's digital locks.
So IBM's massive investment is basically a declaration that the United States intends to win that race at all costs.
Exactly. It's a necessary leap for U.S. technological leadership.
So we've traced the evolution of incredible centralized computing power today, from AMD shrinking the silicon to IBM bending the laws of physics. But the exact opposite approach to computing, decentralized networks, is also undergoing a massive maturation right now.
Yes, crypto.
Yeah, our final topic today focuses on how crypto is transitioning from this highly volatile software experiment into a buttoned-up traditional financial asset.
It is the complete institutionalization of the decentralized.
The newsletter covers Morgan Stanley. They have filed updated S1 registration documents with the SEC for two new exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, focused on Ethereum and Solana.
Which is a huge milestone.
It is.
Yeah.
And the details in these filings show just how aggressive traditional Wall Street is getting. Morgan Stanley set a management fee of just 0.14%.
Wow.
Yeah, which is dramatically undercutting the fees we saw on earlier Bitcoin ETFs. They also selected Coinbase as their primary custodian, meaning Coinbase is legally responsible for holding the cryptographic keys and securing the actual digital assets.
Which builds a lot of trust.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important revelation in this filing is the staking strategy.
Yes. The integration of staking into a publicly traded ETF fundamentally alters the asset class entirely.
Let's define the mechanics of staking for a moment.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like financial magic to a lot of people, but it's actually deeply rooted in computer science.
Right.
Early blockchains like Bitcoin use proof of work, where millions of computers burn massive amounts of electricity to solve puzzles and validate transactions. But Ethereum and Solana use proof of stake. Instead of burning electricity, participants lock up their own digital tokens as a security deposit to become an auditor for the network.
Right.
If you validate the transactions honestly, the network pays you a yield. If you try to cheat or approve a fraudulent transaction, the network mathematically destroys your deposit.
So it replaces energy consumption with financial collateral.
Exactly.
And Morgan Stanley's filings indicate they intend to take the digital assets purchased by the ETF and actively stake them on these networks.
Right.
The trust will take 95% of the staking rewards generated, passing that yield directly to the investors, minus a 5% administrative fee.
Okay, and the yields are pretty solid. They're projecting an annualized yield of around 3.2% for the Ethereum ETF and a rather stunning 6.5% yield for the Solana ETF. Yes. So this is like taking a volatile bar of digital gold and turning it into a digital savings account that actually pays you interest.
Exactly. It moves crypto from pure speculation to income-generating investment vehicles.
Which explains why institutions are finally biting.
It removes the final barrier for massive institutional players like pension funds and sovereign wealth managers.
Because historically, they refused to touch it.
Oh, absolutely. Managing private keys was a massive security liability. The regulatory environment was a complete minefield, and the assets produced no internal cash flow.
Right. It was just hoping the price went up.
Exactly. But now, you have a regulated SEC vehicle secured by a trusted, publicly traded custodian in Coinbase, offering competitive yields alongside rock bottom management fees.
Wall Street can finally model it like a traditional financial product.
It removes all remaining excuses for institutional money to stay on the sidelines.
There is a fascinating technical discrepancy in the filings, though.
Oh.
Morgan Stanley states they will stake up to 100% of the assets in the Solana ETF, but they're only going to stake 50 to 80% of the assets in the Ethereum ETF. Why leave 20 to 50% of the Ethereum just sitting idle, earning zero yield?
So that decision is entirely dictated by the underlying code of the respective blockchains.
Oh, right.
It's an issue of liquidity. See, an ETF has to allow investors to buy and sell shares daily. If a large number of investors decide to sell their shares on a Tuesday, Morgan Stanley needs to instantly convert the underlying digital assets into cash to pay them.
Makes sense.
On the Solana blockchain, the process of unlocking your collateral is designed to be extremely fast. So the fund can safely stake 100% of the assets, knowing they can retrieve them quickly if liquidity is needed.
But Ethereum's architecture is different.
Very different. Ethereum employs a strict withdrawal queue for unstaking, and that's to protect network stability. It can take days or even weeks, depending on network congestion, to get your locked assets back.
Wow. Weeks?
Yeah. And an ETF cannot afford to wait 2 weeks to pay its investors. So Morgan Stanley is forced to keep a massive chunk of their Ethereum unstaked and fully liquid, acting as a permanent reserve to handle daily trading volume.
So the gritty realities of the software architecture are directly dictating the fine print of Wall Street financial products.
They absolutely are.
It is incredible to see how interconnected these massive shifts are. To synthesize everything we've pulled from the newsletter today for you, we are watching a total structural realignment.
A complete paradigm shift.
Yeah. We started with Microsoft shedding the heavy burden of its legacy hardware and physical consoles to retreat into the cloud.
Right.
We saw OpenAI stepping into the physical void they left behind, inventing a screenless, emotionally responsive hardware companion. We unpacked how AMD's dense 2-nanometer silicon provides the edge computing muscle to make those companions possible.
All while IBM's $10 billion quantum leap threatens to rewrite the laws of computing entirely.
Exactly. And all the while, the decentralized computing revolution that birthed crypto is settling comfortably into the rigid regulated structures of traditional Wall Street ETFs. We're watching the old paradigms dissolve and entirely new physical and digital reality solidify right in front of us.
This raises an important question, though.
What's that?
Well, if OpenAI's new ambient hardware successfully integrates into our homes, you know, learning our deepest emotional habits, tracking our physical movements, and acting as a true companion, it will hoard the most intimate personal data imaginable.
The believable amounts of data.
Right. And if IBM's massive quantum investments achieve their goal and eventually shatter the RSA cryptography that secures the modern internet, where does that leave our baseline expectation of privacy?
Oh, man.
Will the very hardware designed to connect with us emotionally become a massive liability when the encryption protecting it becomes completely obsolete?
That is a deeply unsettling reality to consider. The solid walls we've relied on to separate the physical from the digital and the secure from the vulnerable are coming down rapidly. We're going to have to figure out how to build entirely new foundations in real time. Keep questioning the systems you interact with, look for the underlying mechanics behind the daily headlines, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.